From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. The stock market rebounded a bit this morning after an ugly day yesterday. The Dow and S&P both fell by around 2%. That put December on track to be the worst December for stocks since 1931 during the Great Depression. That is all ahead of tomorrow's Fed meeting about whether to hike interest rates. Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent and co-host of Velshi and Rule, joins us with more. Hey, Ali.
Hi, Jeremy.
So we've got this Fed meeting, but we've also got the ongoing trade war with China. What do you think has been behind such a terrible December in the stock market?
Look, so the context here is that we are almost 10 years, well, we're in the 10th year of this expansion, right, without a recession. So statistically, we're due for a recession. Most economists say there's about a 40% chance of one happening in the next 2 years. So that's going to happen. And as interest rates go up, they make other investments seem more interesting. So if you're in your 50s or 60s, and you don't want the risk of the stock market. For the last 10 years, you haven't been able to get interest from a bank account or a savings account. So that's the way it's going to go. You're going to see stock markets start to slow down. The question is, does the Fed continuing to raise interest rates, as it's expected to do tomorrow, and the continuing trade war, where we've heard from China to say, hey, we're in this for the long haul. We can keep this going with you, America, if you want. Do these two things increase the likelihood of a recession, increase the likelihood of it happening sooner, or increase how the likelihood of it being bad? And that's what investors are worried about.
Well, White House advisor Peter Navarro is not blaming the trade war with China. He is firmly putting the blame on the Federal Reserve. Here he is speaking on CNBC.
The predominant factor, hands down, and at the top of the list, is Federal Reserve policy. Donald Trump's instincts are always right on this. And months ago, he started pointing out that the Fed was going too far too fast.
Now, we spoke not too long ago with Alan Greenspan, the former Fed chairman, who said he'd never met a president who wanted him
to
hike interest rates. But that's what the Fed's been doing. The question I have is, isn't the president kind of putting the Fed in a box here? Because if the Fed decides it's not going to raise interest rates as expected, doesn't it look like they're caving to the White House, which they're not supposed to do?
It's a great conversation that I've been having with my co-host, Stephanie Ruhle, that what if the Fed just looks at the evidence and says we don't need an extra rate hike tomorrow? Part of the basis for central banks is that they're not governed by the administration, the executive, the president, the prime minister. So that is putting the Fed in a box. I will say it is worth our listeners knowing that Peter Navarro is a big reason there is a trade war, right? His entire raison d'etre for his entire existence has been pushing back on China. He thinks China is manipulating the whole world, and Donald Trump and Peter Navarro are simpatico on that. And to Alan Greenspan's point, he faced that. Presidents always want interest rates to go down on their watch. Mm-hmm. I will say this. The Fed rate is historically very low. We are nowhere close to high rates or rates that have been crushing. Under Alan Greenspan, we were in double-digit interest rates. So I think everybody's a little too worried about the Fed interest rates. The reality is, when interest rates go up, it makes borrowing more expensive. It slows spending down. It makes house prices come down. It makes the stock market come down. That's sort of the nature of things. It's not indicative of a crisis.
What about the trade war with China? How much is that still weighing on the markets right now?
I think it's bigger. I think that's the bigger issue. The market has lurched downward every time there's been a failure to achieve something with respect to the trade war. That's the biggest concern. We are a nation of consumers more than we are a nation of manufacturers. China is a nation of manufacturers more than they are a nation of consumers. Both of us would like to get a little bit more like each other, but in the midst of a trade war, the country that consumes, you do end up paying more for the same goods that you paid less for in the past. So there's a way to achieve the goals, some of them that the president wants to achieve that are quite noble and that presidents before him wanted to achieve, a fairer trading relationship with China. There are a lot of people who think the way this administration has gone about it is going to be more destructive than productive, and that's what's got markets worried.
Ali, you mentioned that it has been 10 years of growth in this country since the last recession. Now, the last recession was an historically big recession, a historically bad recession. When we eventually do go into a recession again, and maybe it'll be in the coming year, it's not likely to be as bad as that one, right?
I guess we never know.
It shouldn't be. Yeah. I mean, the former Fed chair, Janet Yellen, just made comments on that to say, look, we're going to have a recession. Recessions can be garden variety recessions. When you mismanage them, they become jungle variety recessions like the last one that we had. It doesn't have to be mismanaged, but you have to sort of understand the data and understand what it is you're fighting. One of the things that has to happen in a recession is the Federal Reserve or any central bank has to have ammunition to help the economy. And that ammunition typically is interest rates that can be lowered. One of the Fed's biggest concerns is, what if we have a recession and interest rates are too low to lower them enough to stimulate the economy, which is why the Fed is building up, putting gas in the tank, if you will, by raising interest rates. So the president fighting against that might not be in his interest because the likelihood of a recession during the remainder of Donald Trump's presidency is high, not to do with him, just that it's high statistically. And if the Fed doesn't have the ability to raise interest, to lower interest rates when that happens, that could be a problem. Japan faced that problem. The economy slowed down and interest rates were too low to do anything about it.
Let's just come back as we wrap up this conversation to what they call the most important economic indicator each month, which is the number of jobs that were created. And when you look at the unemployment rate right now, it's historically low, 3.7%. Should we be paying more attention to that than what's happening in the markets?
Sort of. Normally, an unemployment rate below 5% would mean full employment and you'd see wage pressure increasing dramatically. We're not seeing that. That's the problem because a lot of these jobs are low paying or they're multiple, you know, people working multiple jobs. So 3.7% unemployment today doesn't mean the same thing as 5% unemployment did 15 years ago. Structurally, when you have such low unemployment, people should be happy because their wages are higher than they are. And that's not what we're seeing. Now, what we are seeing is examples at Target and Walmart and Amazon of minimum wage being increased. So there is we're starting to see that upward wage pressure, and that should start to equalize things in the course of the next few years. People should actually feel like there's 3.7% unemployment.
That's Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Ali, thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, today a judge delayed sentencing for President Trump's former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn for lying to investigators about his contacts with Russians after Flynn's lawyer said Flynn might need time to testify in another case involving two of Flynn's former business associates facing federal charges of violating foreign lobbying rules for trying to conceal a campaign approved and paid for by high-level Turkish officials to smear cleric Fethullah Gulen, who's living in exile in Pennsylvania. Flynn's company, Flynn Intel, received over $500,000 from the Turkish government. In 2016, when he was advising the Trump campaign, he even wrote an op-ed attacking Gulen. The BBC's Celine Girin is in Istanbul. And Celine, in Flynn's op-ed, he called Gulen a radical Islamist. Delivering the line the Turkish government wanted delivered, they blamed Gulen for the failed 2016 coup. But is there any proof that Gulen was behind that coup?
Well, Turkey has repeatedly alleged that Fethullah Gulen is a terrorist and he was behind the coup attempt that took place back in 2016. And Turkey has repeatedly requested Mr. Gulen to be extradited back to Turkey. And Ankara says they have provided 85 boxes of evidence in support of their case, asking and demanding Mr. Gulen's extradition. But United States officials have said in the past that the Justice Department agents had actually devoted hours going through the evidence that Turkey provided, but they couldn't come to the conclusion that Mr. Gulen had to be extradited as Ankara demanded.
Yeah. Well, when Michael Flynn pled guilty last December to lying to the FBI about his Russian contacts, he also admitted that he had violated the laws requiring that his firm register for working on behalf of foreign clients like the Turkish government. So there is that. But meanwhile, the Turkish government says that the U.S. is now considering their extradition request. Turkey was very involved in exposing the Saudi Arabian story recently about Khashoggi, the journalist who was allegedly murdered in a Saudi embassy in Turkey. Is there a sense that there's some sort of quid pro quo here that, you know, the Trump administration might consider Gulen's extradition to pacify the Turks who are very angry about the Saudi Arabia story?
Tensions rose between the U.S. government and Ankara over how to respond to the killing of Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. And there were allegations that Trump would actually be in favor of the extradition of Fethullah Gulen to Turkey in return for Ankara's handling a more swift approach to the Saudis' involvement in the killing. However, that is one of the issues. There are other fault lines between Turkey and the United States. And recently, Foreign Minister Mevlüt Çavuşoğlu, for instance, said that Trump had told President Recep Tayyip Erdoğan during the meeting, G20 meeting in Buenos Aires, that Washington administration was working on the extradition of Fethullah Gulen. But a White House official who spoke on condition of anonymity denied that such a comment came from Donald Trump. So there is this ongoing tension between Ankara and Washington over Khashoggi, over what's happening in Syria, United States' relationship with the Kurdish forces in Syria, etc. So there are fault lines, but Ankara is trying to play its cards the best it can.
The BBC Selin Giret in Istanbul. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
So it's the holidays. At Thanksgiving, we spoke with an academic, one of the few who studies estrangement, people separating from family members. And boy, did we hear from you out there. Then we recently spoke with best-selling author Tara Westover. Her memoir, Educated, is the story of growing up in an extreme survivalist family and separating from that family to survive. We're going to bring you that whole conversation next week. But Tara mentioned in passing that she wants her next book to be titled Estrangement because it hit such a nerve. Well, I told her about our segment.
It is far and away the most listened to story that we've had on in recent memory.
I think it's such a secret because so few people, I found there was almost no one willing to talk about it. I remember when it was happening, just thinking to myself, like, how can I even believe that I'm a good person if I know that my mother doesn't believe I'm a good person? And how can I ask people to trust me if I'm going to have to tell them, you know, my mother doesn't trust me? And that stigma, that sense is so strong that I think, of course, you never want to tell anybody about it. But the result is everybody's going through it. A lot of people are anyway, and they feel really alone.
Well, so let's address estrangement again, this time with Joshua Coleman, a psychologist in the San Francisco Bay Area. He's also senior fellow with the Council on Contemporary Families and author of several books, including When Parents Hurt, Compassionate Strategies When You and Your Grown Child Don't Get Along. Dr. Coleman, Joshua, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
That title of your book kind of gives away something that actually people said that we didn't cover enough. We approached this topic mostly through the point of view of young adults who felt they had to estrange from their families for safety. I mean, here's a comment from Jack on our website. I heard this segment and I had to pull over. Thank you for affirming the fact that adult children usually estrange because of issues of safety. What's your message about estrangement?
Well, I think it's important that we're not too overly reductionistic in terms of the causes of estrangement. I do think that there are plenty of abusive, neglectful parents, and that estrangement is certainly understandable from that perspective. But I do not believe that constitutes the majority even of people who end up estranging, even though I wouldn't contest the reasons. So other common reasons might be that the adult child is married to somebody who hates the parents and has basically said, choose me or your parents. Mm. That's incredibly common.
Really?
Or the child's mental illness or their addictions. Or the child feels too burdened with worry about the parent and how unhappy the parent's life is. Or the effects of a divorce where one parent poisons the child at any age against the other parent. So the idea that only terrible, abusive, neglectful parents are being cut off from their adult children, I believe, is a myth.
Let's start, though, with those who are in that situation. As you said, there are many, and we heard from them. Here's Christopher writing, my father's an alcoholic. My mother is his enabler. Looked at me and my brother as adults to fix the problems she didn't want to handle. There was physical abuse, weekly beatings with a wooden paddle. I mean, Tara Westover says that the problem for her was not the things that happened to her, mostly from the men in her family, but her mother's denial that they were happening. So if somebody's struggling with that, like we heard Tara say, how can I be a good person if I feel this way? I have to separate from a parent. How do they handle that?
Well, I think it's important to try to do it in a way that you're getting lots of support, that this is something where there's enormous shame on both sides. In some ways, it's a silent epidemic, in part because both parents and adult children don't want to talk about it because they both sides feel like they're going to be blamed or misunderstood. So it's important that you surround yourself with people who have your experience, either through forums or Facebook groups or therapy support groups or individual therapy. Mm. Getting support is critically important.
Yeah, and it sounds like there are a lot of people out there, so there's that. What about, you mentioned mental illness in passing, and we heard a lot of people kind of in defense of parents who said that there were parents who felt that they just could not handle, you know, their adult child's mental illness or a drug addiction, just even as they got older in particular, couldn't handle it anymore.
Well, right. There are certain adult children who they're abusive, they steal from their parents, they threaten their parents. Some adult children move back in with their parents, and then they're very abusive and threatening. And so a certain percentage of adult children, it's not a high percentage. I don't think this is something that either side does whimsically or impulsively. Typically, estrangements happen slowly and over time. And what I'm often counseling my estranged parents of adult children is that, you know, you want to respond as quickly as possible to your child's complaints from a perspective of empathy and assuming that there's at least a kernel of truth to what they're saying. Part of the conflict is that there's this huge generational divide in what's getting called abuse today. From the parents' perspective, a lot of what some adult children say is abusive in their generation might have been considered obnoxious, hurtful, critical, but for the adult child today, they've been socialized in a way that's made them kind of much more psychologically sophisticated. They're more knowledgeable about parenting and these kinds of things. And so that conversation never goes anywhere if the parent just tries to assert the rightness of their perspective. They're far better off empathizing with the child's perspective, with their complaints, taking responsibility, trying to repair the hurt, and feel like you did a good job, and your child could still feel like you did something that was really hurtful or missed something really important about them.
Well, there's two things going on here. One is the parents who have themselves estranged themselves from adult children because of the, you know, let's say with addiction, because of they can't live with it anymore. Another is what you've been saying, parents who've had children estranged from them. We heard from many listeners, one who wrote that said their daughter is estranged. There was no abuse. The daughter is the one who suffers from a mental illness and diagnosed mental illness, and so she is estranged from them. Here's Sherry McGregor, a mother of five adult children, one's estranged. She said she did a lot of research and ended up writing a book, Done with the Crying, Help and Healing for Mothers of Estranged Adult Children, and also a peer support forum, rejectedparents.net. So there are parents who are seeking support when children have estranged from them. But that enrages the children. It enraged a lot of our listeners who said, you know, you parents don't want to accept. You say you don't know why this happened. You're not accepting something.
Well, two things. One is that much more typically, and a little bit of research that's out there shows that more typically it's the adult child who's estranging themselves from the parent. And so sometimes the parent just doesn't understand, and it's partly because of this generational divide. And I don't think it's nearly as important about who's right and who's wrong. I think these can kind of deteriorate from, you know, on the adult child side, thinking of parents as being abusive and toxic, and from the parent side, it can deteriorate into over-entitled children who don't know the meaning of respect. Neither of those occupies a place of particular helpfulness in terms of healing a relationship. It's far more important for there to be an understanding of why parents feel the way that they do and why the adult child feels the way they do. And typically, my counsel is for the parent to take the lead. I do think that the buck stops with the parents. And secondly, because today adult children, the only thing that maintains the tie between the parent and the adult child is whether or not that adult child wants to have the relationship with the parent.
But, doctor, what if, and we've heard from them, what if the young adult does not, it really doesn't ever want to have contact with that parent. And for some, that is the healthiest decision. How do you help a parent with that? You're not getting this relationship back.
Right. Well, two things. One is I always tell parents to say to the adult child, I do understand from your perspective, this feels like this is the healthiest thing for you to do, because that is what it feels like to the adult child. But to your point, first of all, we never know who's going to reconcile and who won't. I mean, I put together the principles in my book, When Parents Hurt, because I wanted to give people a set of guidelines of do's and don'ts. And once an estrangement starts to get triggered, it's like stepping into the quicksand for parents. So they start doing all kinds of things that are highly problematic. They blame the kid. They invalidate them. Mm-hmm. They blame other people, like their ex or their spouse or whatever. They don't do all the empathic things. And some of the families that I've been working with have had reconciliations after 10 years or 20 years. And what little research is out there shows that, in general, most estrangements are time limited, but not all of them. And so if you are a parent and it looks like your kid's never going to reconcile, you have to engage in what one author referred to as radical acceptance. We have to accept that some things are beyond our control. And once we've done everything possible to try to effect change in that relationship, then, and if we can't actually, if it doesn't actually get us what we want, then we have to dig down and find other sources of support and other forms of family and friendships and that kind of thing.
This is for the parent. Sometimes you can't change things. But meantime, you're saying how common this is. We're stunned by it. And so the bottom line, you're not alone.
You're not alone, right. And there's plenty of people on both sides, and there's enormous shame on both sides, so people aren't talking about it as much. And it's critically important that both sides are getting support, because it is such a socially isolating phenomenon.
On either side. That's Joshua Coleman, a psychologist in the San Francisco Bay Area, also a senior fellow with the Council on Contemporary Families, author of several books, one of them, When Parents Hurt, Compassionate Strategies When You and Your Grown Child Don't Get Along. We're also going to link you at hearnow.org to a support group that he finds valuable in the UK for estranged children. It's called Stand Alone. Joshua, Dr. Coleman, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And again, we'll also link you to our previous story. It has lots of listener input for resources. And we'd love your thoughts that may help others at hearandnow.org. And again, our conversation with author Tara Westover, one of the ultimate estrangements from a survivalist family. That conversation that we noted at the beginning of this segment, we'll have that for you next week.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
From NPR and WBUR, it's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. And there's news today that the Trump Foundation is shutting down. The New York Attorney General sued the organization back in June, claiming it misused funds. A judge agreed the suit could go forward. Now, one aspect of that suit is being carried out. The Trump charity will be dissolved under the AG's supervision. It's truly meager assets given out to other charities with her approval. David Farenthold of The Washington Post won a Pulitzer Prize last year for uncovering this story. David, your thoughts on this news?
Well, this was something that we thought might happen. Trump had said he wanted to shut the foundation down, and the New York AG stopped him for a while until they could agree on the terms under which it would be dissolved. So they've now agreed that the charities to which Trump will give the remaining money out of the foundation will have to be approved by the judge in this case and also by the New York AG.
Yeah. That she released a statement. Our petition detailed a shocking pattern of illegality involving the Trump Foundation, including unlawful coordination with the Trump presidential campaign, repeated and willful self-dealing. What it amounted to was the Trump Foundation functioning as little more than a checkbook to serve Mr. Trump's business and political interests. Look, we heard little anecdotes, for instance, about the foundation buying a portrait of Trump and putting it in one of his golf clubs or something like that. What else did the foundation do?
Well, there are two main things that the New York AG focused on. Was one, the Trump Foundation. Trump used it basically as kind of another checkbook for himself, and he used it to pay off legal settlements for two of his for-profit businesses, Mar-a-Lago and one of his golf clubs. Got sued, or they got involved in legal cases where they needed to settle the cases. They said they'd make payments to charity, and instead of the businesses making payments to charity, Trump used his foundation to make those payments to charity, saving his for-profit businesses about $260,000. The other thing that he did was he used his charity as kind of an arm of his political campaign in 2016, giving away its money that he'd raised from other people, giving away the foundation's money in the middle of events that he was holding in Iowa and New Hampshire as a way of kind of burnishing his reputation as a rich guy who cared about giving his money away.
Yeah. Look, it's really quite pathetic because it's revealed that the net assets, I believe, now of the foundation are $1.7 million, which is, you know, nothing for a large foundation. So the money is gone. But there's other parts of the lawsuit as it goes forward. The AG wants $2.8 million in restitution, a ban on Donald Trump and his three older children serving on the board of any other New York nonprofit. That, I mean, talk about that.
That's a really unusual sanction that the New York AG has sought there. That's the kind of thing that they impose on people who operate scam charities, you know, people who set up a nonprofit and use it as a way to bilk people out of their money. It's an unusual sanction to seek in any charity case. It shows how seriously they take what Trump and his family are alleged to have done. The crazy thing about this is not that it would have that much practical impact. I don't think Donald Trump is going to go start another charity. He doesn't serve on any other charity boards right now. But there's this idea that this is the guy who's the head of the free world. He has more power than anyone on the planet, and he's now being told he could not serve. He doesn't have the moral standing to serve on the board of the Staten Island Little League.
Well, he's president of the United States and doesn't have the moral standing to be on the board of the Little League. Look, it also reveals that for all the money the family has, they were using money from a charitable organization. It's going to be interesting to hear what the charitable world had, how they respond to this. The Washington Post's David Fahrenfeld. David, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's get more reaction to all the news out of Washington this week, including President Trump's choice for acting chief of staff, Mick Mulvaney. Remember that? Leon Panetta was chief of staff for President Clinton, as well as both CIA director and secretary of defense for President Obama. Secretary Panetta, welcome back to Here and Now.
Good to be with you, Jeremy.
And first of all, just your reaction to President Trump's choice for what he's calling acting chief of staff, Mick Mulvaney.
Well, I'm not sure the title acting, that seems to be a little bit questionable in terms of whether or not he will be chief of staff. But nevertheless, I think Mick Mulvaney was probably plan B for chief of staff all along. And I suspect that that was probably someone they would turn to in the event others did not want to get the chief of staff's position.
There was talk that it could have even been Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law. Do you think that was a real possibility, or what do you think would have happened if that had been the choice?
Well, that raises concerns because, I think part of the role of chief of staff, obviously, you need to have a relationship of trust with the president, but also you need to have the ability to say no to the president, to look him in the eye and tell him when he's doing something wrong. And if the new person is going to be an effective chief of staff, I think he's got to have the ability to say no to the president.
Do you think that John Kelly's tenure as White House chief of staff was a success? You praised him on this show and elsewhere after he was named.
I think John Kelly, will probably be remembered for kind of a mixed record. On the one hand, he obviously did put in place a strong chain of command and tried to implement strong discipline with the staff. But at the same time, his biggest difficulty was getting the president to accept that discipline. And also, when that relationship began to break down, it obviously impacted on his ability to really be an effective chief of staff.
The other big staff news out of the White House in the last few days is that Ryan Zinke, the Secretary of the Interior, is going to be leaving. He's been the subject of multiple investigations into possible ethics violations and potential conflicts of interest. He said vicious and politically motivated attacks against him have created an unfortunate distraction in fulfilling the agency's mission. What do you think of his tenure in the White House and his departure now?
Well, there's been a record in this administration of cabinet members who have had a very poor record when it comes to abiding by the ethics requirements of those jobs. I mean, we've lost a lot of secretaries. We've lost a lot of people in the White House. And it undermines, obviously, the credibility of not just the president. I think it undermines the credibility of the entire administration when people like that are leaving under a cloud.
Well, and the White House is currently distracted by investigations into the president, into President Trump, his business associates, political advisors, the transition, the inauguration, the charity that he ran, his business organization. What do you make of where we are at this point when it comes to investigations into the president, the Mueller investigation, all of the things that have come out from Michael Cohen, who's been sentenced to a few years in prison?
Well, it means that Mick Mulvaney has his work cut out for him. If he's going to be an effective chief of staff, he's got to find a way to be able to isolate the investigatory side of the White House from the policy side of the White House.
Is that possible?
Well, I faced some of the same problems when I was chief of staff, and it was important to separate the investigations into a separate area handled by counsel and have it not interfere with what the president has to do as president. And if the White House is totally consumed by all of these investigations, then you can bet that it will undermine the ability of the president to do what he's supposed to do as president in dealing with the interests of the country.
Where do you come down on whether a sitting president can be indicted?
Well, obviously the Justice Department has issued, a memo with regards to the inability to indict a sitting president. I guess my view is if there is a case that can be made that could lead to a possible indictment, then I think there is a case to be made that raises questions with regards to the president's ability to serve in the office of the presidency. And I think our founding fathers were smart enough to provide other ways to get at a president if, in fact, he's broken the law.
Well, one of the ways is impeachment, but Democrats seem to be hesitant to go down that road.
Well, that's understandable at this point because we really don't know what the Mueller investigation shows. I think it's smart to basically hold your powder until you've had a chance to see what Bob Mueller has presented in his investigation. I think Bob Mueller is a professional. He's somebody who's done, I think, a very careful job at trying to find the truth here. I think his report will largely determine what will or will not happen with the President of the United States.
The Washington Post obtained a copy of a report on Russian interference in the election prepared for the Senate Intelligence Committee. And the report apparently details how the Russian government used social media to spread disinformation about U.S. politics going back as early as 2013, which overlaps with your tenure as Secretary of Defense, which ended in 2013. Was that on your radar back then, Russian social media interference?
Well, at the intelligence agencies, particularly when I was director of the CIA, there was always concern about what the Russians would be trying to do with regards to the use of social media and also with regards to trying to undermine our stability. They are an adversary in the intelligence business. We knew very well that the Russians would do everything they could to try to undermine the stability of the United States. And that's something that I think has always been a blinking yellow light when it comes to the intelligence agency's relationship to Russia.
And was there something that could have been done to stop them from interfering?
Well, when you're dealing with social media, I'm always a believer that the best defense is a good offense. You've got to show them that you can basically interrupt their affairs as well using our capabilities. You've got to send them a clear signal that their ability to interfere with the United States is not a free ride. They're going to have to pay a price for that. And I'm a little concerned that, frankly, there wasn't enough of an offense to go after the Russians to make clear that they would have to pay a price for what they were doing.
As we speak to you right now, we're just a few days away from another possible government shutdown. The big battle is over whether the Congress will fund President Trump's border wall. The Democrats don't want to do that. The president doesn't want to budge. What do you think the Democrats should do right now?
Well, you know, all of this is a good reflection of the dysfunction in Washington. I mean, we've been going through this kind of song and dance for a number of years now, where there's a threat of a shutdown, and sometimes there is a shutdown over sometimes silly issues, over sometimes substantive issues. But the fact that it happens constantly is an indication that, frankly, both the Congress and the president are irresponsible in the way they're dealing with the budget issues confronting this country. I mean, one way or another, they've got to find a way to keep the government running. And they've got to be able to find some kind of compromise here in order to make that happen. If they take the attitude that they're basically going to say to hell with it, if the president wants to shut the government down, let him go ahead and do it. Frankly, I think both sides lose in that contest.
So you think that the Democrats should budge?
I think the Democrats and the Republican leadership need to sit down and determine what is the best approach here to trying to make sure that the government stays open. You know, they did cut a deal on the budget. They did agree as to how much should go to border security. The smartest thing to do would be to stick to the deal and hopefully get enough votes to override a president's veto.
That is Leon Panetta, former White House Chief of Staff, former CIA Director, Secretary of Defense, and a lot of other things as well. Thank you so much. As always, great to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, Chairman.
And it's been well established by U.S. intelligence that Russians interfered with the 2016 U.S. elections. But still, the two third-party reports released Monday by the Senate Intelligence Committee were stunning. They show the Russian troll factory behind that country's online misinformation campaign, the Internet Research Agency, or IRA, switched from Facebook to Instagram once Facebook started tightening security, and among other things, worked social media to keep African Americans away from the polls, where they might vote for the Democrat Hillary Clinton instead of Donald Trump. So how is this reverberating with tech companies? Let's go to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Kurt Wagner is senior editor of social media at Recode. Hi, Kurt.
Hi, Robin.
And these independent reports came from social media companies, and the numbers are stunning. Posts from Instagram accounts linked to IRA, again, the Russian trolls, received nearly 185 million likes over 2 years, about 4 million comments. Remind us, you know, for those especially who don't use Instagram, what was the difference for the Russians?
Well, I think that a lot of the attention thus far has been put on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter, and there was, you know, evidence that these trolls were using Instagram, but had kind of been overshadowed by these other platforms. So I think when the reports came out yesterday, it was really shocking to realize that the most effective platform for them was Instagram, when everyone had kind of been looking over here at, you know, Facebook in particular. So just realizing that Instagram played such a significant role, and the fact that Instagram has such a you know, young audience here in the United States, I think caught a lot of people by surprise.
Well, and the Internet Research Agency, again, the IRA, these Russian trolls, reached thousands of followers and made them micro-influencers. What does that mean?
Micro-influencers is pretty much someone that has, you know, as the name describes, influence over a particular group of people online. It might not necessarily be a household name that you've heard of, but it's someone that does have a significant following. So this is people with more than 10,000 followers are considered kind of a micro-influencer. And a lot of the pages that were set up by the IRA were able to kind of achieve that level of popularity.
And talk about what the Russians did. I mean, we've kind of known about this, but it's being laid out so much more clearly, going after different niche groups, you know, anti-Clinton, pro-Trump, but also a kind of an African-American focus to keep African-Americans away from the polls.
Yeah, a lot of what came out in these reports was stuff, at least at a high level, that we already knew, which is that these Russian trolls really tried to divide American voters by publishing posts about hot-button topics, right? So things like pro-gun posts or anti-immigration posts. In terms of targeting kind of African-American communities, the report said, you know, they went after, quote, structural inequalities that are faced by African-Americans. Those might be things like police violence or incarceration. So all of the content from these posts was meant to, you know, stir up strong emotions and feelings and also kind of divide people by stoking, you know, what social media does best, unfortunately, which is get people really riled up behind a keyboard.
Yeah. You know, very few. Actually, I think they found no pro-Hillary Clinton posts at all. But what does this say about what companies have been saying about their platforms? They've made, they've had testimony under oath to Congress. And the researchers seem to be suggesting that Facebook executives dissembled about the IRA's voter suppression efforts on the platform. And they also questioned Google's disclosures to the Senate Intelligence Committee at that hearing in 2017. Tell us more about what the researchers are finding there.
I think that there is some concern that if some of these executives, many of whom have now gone and testified before Congress at some point this year, that's including CEO Mark Zuckerberg at Facebook, CEO Jack Dorsey at Twitter, and just recently Sundar Pichai over at Google. There is some concern. Was anything that they said, you know, misleading now that we have all of this other insight into the posts? And if that's the case, could there be some kind of consequence for that? I think from a more likely scenario is that this might, finally spur Congress to enact some kind of regulation around these companies and say, you need to have better control over, you know, how people are using your platform. Because as we've learned, there is really no control. I mean, people can kind of say whatever they want. And as we see from this report, it can be manipulated very easily.
Well, you know, it's quite something because we are still looking at a midterm election that's being questioned because it turned out that there were people going door to door taking people's ballots, saying they'd fill them out for them. Hmm. When you think about how exponentially how much more interference you can do when you do as these Russian trolls did, when you text to people, you can now text me your vote. And people did. I mean, when you think of how much more you can disrupt an election because of the multiplying aspect of social media, it's pretty shocking.
There's just so much scale at these companies, and it's really hard to even wrap your head around. I mean, you hear, for example, I think Facebook is somewhere around 2.3 billion users worldwide, and it just sounds like a big number, but when you think about what 2.3 billion people that are all using one service, I mean, it's really shocking. And so these networks are basically set up to make things reach a wider audience. So you post something, and if your friends like it or comment on it, they show it to more people, and so you can reach a huge audience.
Kurt Wagner, senior editor of Social Media at Recode. Kurt, we'll keep an eye on this. Thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.